I think the reality is that the recession risk is much higher. The truth of the matter is that there's a very, very significant portion of the US population that is in recession. We're at a point where the post-1945, the post-Second World War, world order is ending. And that world order was America helped Europe stand up and then helped Europe unify and build a powerful Europe. The United States is now saying, or Trump is now saying, I should say, I'm not sure it's a general sentiment in the United States, is those years are over.
Okay, so why do you think the stock is a meltdown? Do you think it's just the...
I think we're in an... I think we've come out of a period where stocks, the value of stocks did not represent the real risk and the reality. And I think they were just, particularly the Magnificent Seven or whatever the Mag Seven, they were just priced to such perfection that any disruption in the economy would actually cause a perturbation, and we're in that perturbation now. And, you know, there's a very severe risk right now of recession, serious recession, and Trump has said so, you know, pretty frankly, and he's right. I think there is risk, a pretty high risk of a severe recession. I see that Goldman said this morning that there's a 1 in 5 chance of recession in the coming year. I think the reality is that the recession risk is much higher. The truth of the matter is that there's a very, very significant portion of the US population that is in recession.
Yeah.
So small businesses, particularly, you know, very small businesses, and areas of the country, particularly, you know, in the Midwest, in the Southeast, are really struggling. I mean, truly struggling.
Yeah.
And there's, while there's a very low unemployment being reported, there's a very high unemployment in particular sectors.
Yeah.
So we have this recession that is in a portion. You know, it is really a very selective recession.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been this way for quite a long time, actually. Yeah. So the question is, at what point does this, you know, disruption, what point does this really become disruptive? What point does it actually spill over to the larger population? And the adjustments that Trump is making to the economy, to the economic system, is pretty significant. So,
and quick too, and fast,
and very
and chaotic,
and very chaotic.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, you know, I have this long conversation on X, in a group chat about these tariffs, and friends from Europe are very angry about this tariff business. And so when I point out the disparity in tariffs between Europe and the US, and that they've been very long-standing and they've been boiling under for years, actually, in particular vehicles, for example, there's a huge disparity.
Can you give a specific example, right? So the tariff, US cars going in, right?
We charge Europe a 2% tariff on their vehicle imports into the United States, on European vehicles being imported into the United States.
Mercedes, BMW, et cetera.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They tariff us 10%.
Yeah.
So there's 5X. Agricultural goods. There's a huge disparity in agricultural goods between the United States and Europe. The European market is a very significant market. We are a very significant market for Europe. The theory of tariffs is that there should be no tariffs between us, and then each country would, you know, on the merits of the products they produce, would sell into the other country, bringing down costs in each country. That's the general theory, economic theory.
Yeah.
Well, once you start tariffs, then you start you know, destroying this whole thing. And this has been a bone of contention between Europe and America for years and years, such that it's almost a habit. And people have got used to it.
Mm.
What Trump is saying, no, we're not used to it. We're not gonna allow this situation to continue.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's changing the conversation. The conversation has always been very polite, and both sides have been very patient. I think there are some tariffs that the U.S. has on Europe. The most important one of which is the so-called chicken tariff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the chicken tariff is where we charge, I think, a very high percentage for trucks, light trucks.
Okay.
We charge European exporters very high tariff for trucks.
Yeah.
Light trucks. But Europe doesn't make light trucks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a pointless, I mean, it's not really truly a bone of contention. Anyway, bottom line is, Europe's angry.
Yeah.
Now, one only has to look at the disparity in expenditures in NATO to say, yes, but,
yeah,
you know, you charge us higher tariffs and we're paying for the cost of bearing, we're bearing the cost of building a strength for NATO.
Yeah.
So we're at a point where the post-1945, the post-Second World War, world order is ending. And that world order was America helped Europe stand up and then helped Europe, you know, unify and and build a powerful Europe. And the United States is now saying, or Trump is now saying, I should say, I'm not sure it's a general sentiment in the United States, is that those years are over.
Yeah.
We're in a new world. You stand on your own. We stand on our own. And you pay your own way on defense. You pay your own way. And if you have a tariff on us, we will tariff on you.
Yeah. I think the NATO point is an interesting one, too. It's like, which was eye-opening for me. The GDP per capita that the U.S. funds NATO. So the NATO member states in Europe are about a 580 million population. The U.S. is 330 million, but the U.S. is funding NATO 2-1.
Absolutely.
So that's effectively a 6-1, you know, GDP per capita funding of, you know, NATO. So it's kind of like the U.S. citizen has six times the burden of a European citizen to defend Europe, right? But that doesn't, in that conversation, you know, and I'm not saying like necessarily should we or should we not.
Those figures aren't quite right.
Okay.
So you have to understand, the United States also defends the Pacific.
Sure.
So States expenditure on arms is not exactly, you know, pari passu with Europe. On the other hand, one can argue Europe also needs to participate.
Right.
In the defense of the Pacific.
Which they don't currently,
which
right?
They don't, well, right. It, just look at the disparity in expenditures.
Yeah.
To see that, you know, Europe is not paying its way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, ideally, the percentage of GDP spent by both Europe and the United States should be the same.
Similar. Yeah, at the very least. Yeah, that's an interesting sort of thing out there. Let me ask you this. So I was listening to, do you listen to Two Way at all? The Two Way podcast? It's no. Awesome. It's I started watching it when Mark Andreessen went on it, and it's this it's a panelist with a person from the left and a person from the right. It's similar to Breaking Points in a way.
You know what, I listened to the Mark Andreessen one.
Okay, yeah. Yes, it's excellent. They do two shows a day, one in the morning, one in the evening, and it's a good way of understanding sort of like the politics of what's going on with Trump today. I think one of the points I brought up today is like, hey, like, are you sure you want to start a fight with people like Canada, Mexico, as an example? Are you sure you want to do the same sort of tariff war with like your closest allies? How do you perceive this thing that's going on with Canada and Mexico? Because like, for me, it's like, I give the benefit of the doubt to these folks because I'm like, hey, these people are in power. I'm guessing they have some sort of strategy. Maybe this is a bargaining chip. Maybe they're sitting down and saying, okay, if we put pressure on Mexico and Canada, maybe we get a better deal long term or something like that. Maybe they have taken advantage of us in some way. But I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, let me tell you where I come from politically. I was a never Trumper, truly a never Trumper. I had regarded him as someone who should not be in the political conversation because his political conversation was out of bounds.
Yeah.
And I regard
crude would be a nice way of putting it.
Thank you. You call a spade a spade.
Yeah.
And you know, when he won the 2016 election, I was shocked. I was shocked. On the day of the election, on the morning of the election, I was in Israel, so I was asleep, absolutely. I went to bed absolutely certain Hillary would win.
Yeah.
And wasn't my choice. Hillary wasn't my choice, but anything but Trump.
Yeah,
was what I, you know, what I thought. So when I came downstairs in the elevator in the hotel that morning, there was this gigantic crowd. I mean, you know, I couldn't understand what was going on, and there was, you know, some sort of jubilation and some sort of cries of pain. I mean, it was like,
yeah,
it was like a riot down there. I said, what's going on? I said, haven't you heard? No, Trump won. I said, what? And my world turned upside down. Yeah, and but the shock for me came kind of as a rolling shock because really until the pandemic, every single policy that he, not every single, but by and large, the policies that he implemented, which sounded crazy at the time, seemed to have worked well. And the pandemic was a disaster, truly a disaster. But when Biden won the election, I had no idea of just how bad the administration would become. And so by the time the critical moment, that is the assassination attempt, the first assassination attempt on Trump came, I was already very, very, very unhappy with Biden and very unhappy with the Democratic direction, very unhappy with woke politics, extremely unhappy with woke politics. I mean, I lived in South Africa, which was, a fascist state.
Yeah.
And to me, everything that was going on, you know, it gave me like post-traumatic stress syndrome. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was just shocked at how the government was acting. And I was also at that point getting extremely, you know, suspicious about everything that was going on. I looked back at the so-called, you know, Russiagate and how the justice system had corrupted the politics. Anyway, bottom line is the assassination attempt on Trump and his reaction turned me upside down.
Again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely upside down because, you know, it kind of opened my eyes to the fact that this guy was a once in a lifetime unique character. And there have been many in history. Anyway, long story short, I became a Trump supporter.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of went on the same journey that Elon was on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had become progressively, you know, upset, more and more upset with what the Democrats are doing. And then suddenly realized that, hey, this guy is not as crazy as he sounds. Anyway, so that was my journey.
Yeah.
And it was not different from the journey that many of my friends and colleagues and family were on.
Yeah. I went through a similar one with him, honestly.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. For sure. Yeah.
So, you know, it's really hard to have a conversation with friends who are on the other side. Very, very hard because everybody gets so hot under the collar.
Yeah.
it seems to me we should be able to talk about these things.
Yeah. And so I think, and I can hit the tariff question in a bit, but I think it's just, you know, even in today's climate, as soon as the Trump name gets mentioned and you're trying to have a discussion, it's just Trump is persona non grata, right? It's like the devil incarnate.
Yeah.
With some folks, I'm not saying with everybody.
It upends the conversation.
Yeah,
and I'm sure that many, many people are going to have switched off this conversation if they started watching.
By now, yeah.
By now, sure. Because of, you know, all the things we've said about
Trump. But he's the president of the United States. He was voted by the, not by the majority of the population, but by the majority of the popular vote. He won the Electoral College by quite a bit. He swung 85% of the counties towards Trump, right? So he's in power for a reason. I think the one thing that I'm trying to get my sort of head wrapped around is I knew there was going to be chaos coming in just because of, if you view the first Trump administration, he sort of tries to implement policies through his own way. You know, he has a certain way of doing rhetoric. He tries to paint everything as a win, right? You know, he's a great politician, but with the combination of Elon and the cabinet he has put forth, I expected super fast, super furious, but now we're in the thick of, okay, now you're implementing all these policies. What is your end goal? What are you trying to do? And I think the Mexico-Canada conversation specifically, that's the one that I'm trying to get my, and I don't know if you have any takes on this, is the Canada-Mexico conversation is we're trying to do tariffs to try and essentially even the playing field. And I'm trying to understand, okay, is that a good strategy long term? When you're, you know, is this going to really piss off Canada and Mexico, or is this just politics? Is he trying to, you know, set the United States in a more advantageous position? Is all of this trying to lower inflation by tanking the economy so that we can refinance our debt at 3% instead of 5% in the United States, right? There's $11 trillion, I think, coming due for a refinance or something in the next few months. Is this all a concerted effort to just try to get the debt situation, you know, in control? After decades of just, you know, taking on more and more debt, $36, $37 trillion of debt or whatever we have now. Like, I'm trying to understand what's going on. I don't know if you have a good answer.
Well,
I don't know if anybody does.
I think the answer is quite simple.
Yeah. Because,
and there's a lot to unpack with what you said. And so I'm not going to try and unpack each and every one of them. But except to say, I gave this whole long story about my journey with Trump because I wanted to point out one important thing. At the end of this story, what I've concluded is that Trump looks at facts in the most naive way possible. And by that, I mean not that he's simple and naive, but that he looks at the facts and he separates them from the history. In other words, fact, Europe charges the United States tariffs that the United States doesn't charge Europe. Fact, Europe is not paying its way for its own defense.
Yeah.
Fact, Mexico and Canada have a huge disparity in some of their trade deals with the United States. Fact, you know, these are just simple facts. Now, there's a history behind them, and there's a reason and a cause behind them. And some of the reasons and cause may be very good.
Yeah.
But these are the facts. He looks at the facts and said, those are not good facts. Now, the most important fact that he looks at is the trillions of dollars of debt that we have and the path that we're on.
Yeah.
Which is unsustainable. That which is unsustainable will not be sustained.
And that is not part of the conversation at all in 99% of the discussions.
That is the point.
Yeah.
That his naivete is essential for us to understand what we're doing to our own country, what we're doing to ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary to have this naivete. It's extraordinary in today's very sophisticated world where we have these layers of history on every one of our policies, and those layers keep those policies intact, even though those policies are driving us towards destruction. So this is a once in a lifetime. This is an Andrew Jackson. This is a once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, coincidence. Now, that brings us to Elon.
Yeah.
Now, Elon's put himself in an extremely vulnerable position.
Yeah.
But you know, he's been doing this his entire life.
Yeah. It's par for the course.
It's absolutely par for the
course. It's just the stakes are 100 times bigger.
He keeps raising the stakes. Now, you know, there's a obvious risk that he's going to fall flat on his face on one of these risks. And I mean, you know, he's been there before. He's been there, you know, at a personal risk, from a financial perspective, from a success perspective, and so on and so forth. And he's bested each risk.
Yeah.
And sometimes he's failed, but he's overcome that failure by, you know, the next step.
Yeah.
What troubles me is at the end of all of this, when the Republicans lose the presidency, you know, does the successive Democratic majority become, you know, really, really nasty? And they, and you know, the federal government has the power to be extraordinarily nasty, as we've seen in recent years.
Yeah.
It's unpleasant that we're in this tit for tat cycle, which I haven't seen in my whole life.
Wow.
I mean, the last time we got anywhere close to this was the McCarthy era. You know, you're familiar with the McCarthy era. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, at that point, the McCarthy mob was a pretty serious, and they destroyed many lives. But I think we're in a far, far worse situation now than we were in the McCarthy era.
Yeah, I think the Elon conversation is very interesting, because I feel like short of delivering on a true turnaround on the direction of the country, specifically as it pertains to the debt, the reliance on printing money, the huge disparities in exports and manufacturing. Like, this is when I try to follow the day-to-day to understand sort of the trends, and just, you know, it's such a fascinating time, right? It's hard to look away. It's like, okay, I want to understand what's going on. But the overarching arc of insane debt, out of control spending, and a huge gap in our ability to manufacture, that to me is by far the most important thing. And so the question becomes, what things do we have to put in place to ensure that we can reverse that trend, right? And short of Elon and Trump and the administration in the next 4 years being able to show measurable improvements in that, I fear that in 4 months from now, because of how divided we are and because of what the kind of rhetoric that's coming out of both sides, right? Elon's not helping himself. Trump is not helping himself, you know? And the Democrats, you know, I'm former Democrat. I left the party because they were so vitriolic, because they were so unaccepting of thoughts that might, you know, be like, hey, I think that's a stupid thing to do. You know, it feels like a racist policy. You know, you're the, you know, party of anti-hate and anti-racism, but you're implementing all these racist policies. You evil, you know, you Trump supporter, how dare you? Okay, all right, that's crazy. I gotta leave. Whereas on the Trump side, and you know, there's definitely some of that on the extremes, but it's a lot more, I feel like there's more dissent towards Trump even within his own party. Like the whole thing that happened with the Massey thing, where he was, you know, calling to primary him, and is one of the most respected Republicans out there, right? So there's a lot of dissent even within his party, which I enjoy. The point I'm trying to make is, I think there is an opportunity for Elon and Trump to really deliver on a transformation that we haven't seen, a true transformation. But the amount of execution that's going to be required and the timeline that they are able to do that in feels so short that, short of causing the chaos that we're seeing today, I don't see how you actually deliver on that promise.
Well, the only way to deliver on that promise, no, that's not true. I shouldn't say that. It's not the only way. But one way to deliver on that promise is for this administration to continue in the next, you know, after this 4 years, to continue for another 8 years. So J.D. Vance or, you know, somebody gets elected and they continue along this path. But if at the end of this path, the job is only half done and we're going through terrible pain, we could well see, you know, a Democrat, a woke party emerge victorious. And then, you know, they will go after Elon in the most
vicious
way.
Yeah.
So, you know, the risks are pretty high. You're right. The risks are pretty high. And everything you've said, I'm aligned with. I mean, it's so strange that I came from, you know, I came to the United States first in 1963 as a very idealistic young man. I was brought into political consciousness by John F. Kennedy.
Yeah.
I mean, even today I can recite his inauguration, his first inauguration speech, his only inauguration speech. I know it word perfectly because I pored over that speech. I couldn't believe this clarion call to service, you know, and I was living in an apartheid state. And so, you know, I had to get out of there and I had to come here. And that was the year that Kennedy was shot. You know, I was in school and we were out in the field and, you know, this bell rang and we heard the news. It was, you know, it changed my life. So what's happening now is so upsetting. I know some people think he's the devil incarnate and other people think he's the savior. He's neither. But the one thing he is, Mr. Trump, is he's an eye opener because he's saying these unfiltered things, as I talked about, these things that we are not prepared to actually say out aloud and we're not even aware of. We're not even thinking about.
They're directionally correct very, very often.
Yes,
yeah.
They're directionally absolutely correct.
Yeah.
But they're almost unsayable.
Yeah.
And so Elon, you know, we know that Elon feels these things, you know, he looks at the reality of things, and once he realizes the reality of things, that's it. You know, he's got to fix that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if only he can succeed. And, you know, there's nobody else, I think, in the world.
Yeah.
Nobody in the world.
Yeah.
Who has any chance of succeeding at this but Elon.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the, you know, you talked about all these problems in the United States, but the one thing you didn't mention, the biggest single problem is the bureaucracy.
which I feel like everyone has always tried to fight, but they always fail because they don't have the willingness to survive the pain, to survive the attacks, or to even just understand how deep it goes. That's my sense.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Because at the bottom of all these problems lies this huge, they call it the swamp. I think it's a really bad name for it, a really bad name. But it is really driving us towards a 1984 world, you know. It's driving us towards a world where we have become, as Elon likes to say, not a democracy, but a bureaucracy.
Right.
And that's really the reality of it.
Yeah.
I mean, the levels of power that the government has, state, municipal, state, and national is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, the police can literally stop you in the road, look at you, see what cash you have on you, take your cash away, and they're absolutely impervious to any, you know.
Right.
I mean, they have that power today, and they are doing it to people.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah. You sound like a liberal, Larry.
You see, that's the whole thing that I was brought up, you know, in the notion of liberal democracy.
Yeah. Same, yeah, same.
And so, you know, I mean, you come from a country where, you know, I mean, what those people are crying for democracy.
Yeah. My parents were. I was born in Spain. My parents are both Iranian, but you know, they. Yeah, that country has a host of, I don't even want to mention them, but I just find it so interesting. You know, the one thing that I always heard when I remember when I was watching politics in the periphery, you know, this is and again, I'm 38 years old. I really started following it about 5 years ago, deeply to try to understand it. But the one thing, the thing that I always heard was, you know, all these politicians always make a promise and then they get into office and then it's different, right? They can barely execute the thing because, you know, not only do they have to, you know, come to a conclusion in Congress, right? But there's also this underlying thing, which is the bureaucracy, that's just going to keep doing what it's doing anyway. It's become its own thing. And now it's becoming clear to me, is like, wow, could this whole thing have been that politicians know that it's going to be extremely difficult to actually execute on what their mandate was from their constituents, and they come in and they have to play the game. That it's been a game that has been played for the last 30, 40, 50, 60 years because they know it's going to be extremely difficult and almost a lost cause if they actually executed against what they ran on.
Well, the only...
Am I going up the wrong tree?
No, the only quibble I will have about the tree you're going up is it's not 30, 40, 50, 60 years. It's 300 years. I mean, we've been at this hundreds of years. And so we've got an accretion. We've got layers upon layers upon layers upon layers. But I think in the current circumstance has become terminal. And it's reflected in our debt.
Yeah.
It's reflected in the fact that the people in Congress are so far removed from the reality of that debt.
Yeah.
And the bureaucracy is so far removed from the reality of that debt.
Because they rely on getting paid.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
From that debt.
But the most important, I think, the most important thing I've learned from the last few months. It's only a few weeks, actually. I was going to say the last 6 months, but it's actually the last six
feels
weeks.
Like 6 years.
Yeah. It's only 6 or 8 weeks, I think. Is the degree of corruption in this NGO structure thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it pains me that the Democrats will not give recognition to the understanding that we are now developing about this NGO structure. Do you know about
it? Is where there are government-funded, non-governmental organizations that receive funding from the taxpayer to basically execute on something that they want, and there's no check to actually ensure that the money that they are receiving is actually being executed for those things.
So that's the first order problem.
Yeah.
There's no check on what the NGO does.
Yeah.
But there's a second order problem that really raises the problem to the level of crisis for the country. And that is the NGO doesn't then directly execute the task. The NGO then contracts with a second NGO to contract that task.
This is the Data Republican thing that did this whole study of linking all the different NGOs or whatever. Yeah.
Then the second NGO.
Goes to the third one.
Now it goes seven levels deep.
That's insane.
It goes seven levels deep in many cases. And here's the thing. Each NGO has salaried staff.
Yeah.
And those salaries eat into that mission.
Yeah.
So the time you get to the seventh NGO, and maybe that's a unique situation, maybe that's a one-off situation, but it sure doesn't look like it to me.
Yeah.
But what you end up having is this gigantic amount of money going into people's pockets. And who are those people? Those people were staffers in Congress. They were people in Congress, or they were people in some role in government.
Wow.
So it becomes a very compelling thing for somebody in government to seek a role in these NGOs quite innocently and quite honestly.
Yeah.
So even if you're innocent and honest, you're part of the problem.
Yeah.
And that's when corruption becomes normalized. You see, the whole structure is corrupt.
Yeah.
But when corruption becomes normalized and you don't think about it as corruption, you think you're doing quite a good thing.
Right.
That's the ultimate corruption.
100%. Yeah, 100%. How much, do you know how much goes from the how much NGOs receive from the federal government every year? Do you have that figure on you? And we'll ask.
And you know, you ask the federal government, but you should really ask for the federal and state, because
okay.
one of my theses is not that the federal government is is bloated, but the federal and state governments are bloated, because people often quote the cost that we're paying to maintain our federal government,
yeah.
but they forget that the state governments have become incredibly large as well.
Yeah. Can I give you a trivia question? See if you get this right. What percentage of our GDP is federal, state, and local expenditure every year? As a percentage of GDP, what do you think it is?
So I think it's in the range of 30%.
32%.
In the range of
Doesn't that sound crazy?
It is absolutely insane. Bananas. It's insane.
Like, why? Why is it that?
If you go back to the founding of the country, it was less than 3%. Less than 3%.
I'm almost afraid to ask the question of like, how do we get to this point? Because it's such a stupid question to ask, because it's obvious that even asking that question doesn't really solve the problem.
It's the law of accretion. It's the law of accretion, and the law applies to bureaucracy.
Yeah.
That the bureaucracy is self perpetuating. So once you have the self perpetuation, then every time you add, you're adding something that becomes permanent. You know, we had Reagan try and trim the federal government. We had actually the most effective trimming of the federal government was done by Clinton.
Yeah, with Gingrich, right? With Newt Gingrich, I think.
Yeah. Clinton, Gingrich. Yeah. You know, they did a fantastic job together. And you know, we had out of that combination, Reagan followed by Clinton, we had 20 years of you know, extreme wealth generation in the country.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really troubling that we've allowed this to happen, and it's happened at such an alarming rate in the last couple of decades.
Yeah. So I asked Perplexity, annual government funding to NGOs, a comprehensive analysis of federal and state contributions. Based on recent data, federal and state governments collectively allocate over $300 billion annually to NGOs through grants, contracts, and other mechanisms. $300 billion.
Well, that's a relatively small amount because it's, it's about 10%. Well, that's actually quite a big amount.
Yeah,
it's about 10% of the budget.
Well, that's federal and state.
Federal and state. So it's about 5% of the budget.
Still, I mean, 5%.
Actually, you know, it's different because federal is much higher percentage of state.
Yeah.
So it's probably,
6 or 7%.
Yeah, in that order. But that's a big number. Now, some of that is legitimate expenditure, but I bet you, if Elon were managing that, it could be halved.
It could be probably one-tenth.
One-tenth. I mean, that's true. Yeah. I mean, Elon could do that. But, you know, not every bureaucracy could be run by Elon.
So, okay. What is an NGO? Like, what is it actually? Like, the non-governmental organization label is...
Firstly, it's a charitable organization.
Okay.
No, let me rephrase that. It is an organization which is not taxable.
Okay.
Because it's not, it doesn't derive profits. It doesn't operate for the purpose of accumulating profits.
Yeah.
It operates for the purpose of achieving some goal that the government wishes to achieve, and which is not for the purpose of profit, but for the purpose of service. The point of service is that it tries to achieve a goal which the government is trying to achieve.
Using taxpayer-funded dollars to execute that goal.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's not government. And why the government would need a non-government organization?
That's where I'm confused.
Well, I mean, in theory, it helps by not creating a perpetual bureaucracy, right?
Right.
But I mean, there has
to... Boy, that worked.
Wasn't that good?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it would be interesting to hear somebody tell us why a non-government organization is necessary. Now, the government does fund a lot of foreign aid mm-hmm. through NGOs that operate in other countries, which the government clearly would not be able to do. So yeah. maybe there's that.
And a lot of that is justified as soft power, right? It's like, hey, this is like, if we get people on our side in other countries by giving them aid, then that gives us...
Well, let's go back to 1963. I spoke about why I came to the country and so on.
Yeah.
It was interesting because I stayed with a host family, an American family. Mm-hmm. And the father, the parent in the family was a New York attorney,
yeah.
a very senior New York attorney, who had been... Avril Harriman's, I think he was in Avril Harriman's campaign to firstly become governor of the state of New York and then to try and become president,
yeah.
try and get the presidential, the candidate nomination in 1960 and against Kennedy and lost to Kennedy. And then Harriman joined Kennedy in his campaign and this surrogate father of mine helped that campaign, and his reward was he was brought in by Kennedy to draft the USAID bill. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I got to understand the USAID very well. Mm. And the USAID was part of Kennedy's entire, you know, campaign. And I always thought it was a very fine thing for the U.S. to do.
Very noble.
Very noble. Because, you know, look at how U.S. had helped Europe stand up. You know, the Marshall Plan was, you know, part of the reasons, part of the idealistic sort of structure that I'd created in my mind. And look at what U.S. had done for Europe. Because, you know, as a youngster, I studied Churchill in very deeply, the Second World War very deeply, and what happened to Europe after the Second World War was of great moment to me.
Yeah.
So the USAID was always in my mind a pillar of US policy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But now when you look at it and how it's become bureaucratized and what it is doing and what values it espouses,
yeah,
it's like an entirely different organization.
It's 60 years of unchecked power, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Of unchecked direction.
Unchecked direction. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like any company, right? Any company, you let it go for 60 years without a clear goal and a clear leader and somebody who can refocus the company to the true intention of the company over time, what ends up happening, it just divulges and sort of it gets bastardized into some other thing.
But also, if you look at the world today, the question is, what helps and what hinders countries in the third and the fourth world to evolve, develop, and to prosper? And the question is AID and the methods and means of AID helpful or hurtful? And it's extraordinarily difficult to figure that out.
Yeah.
It's extraordinarily difficult.
Because it's probably a little bit of both.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's probably a little bit of both. Yeah. And it's almost like, you know, I sometimes do wonder, it's like, there are ways to help other nations, other places in the world that are suffering, that would benefit tremendously from the United States, you know, going in and helping in some way. I think the thing that's very, like, I think the reason ultimately why Trump is the president and why so many people support him in the United States specifically is that for decades, they've watched the United States help others while communities have been destroyed. While they've been falling apart with the exit of manufacturing in places like Detroit, all the impacts in sort of the Midwest and with the fentanyl crisis and all these different downtrodden areas. I think there's an overwhelming sense from the US that says, hey, like, we're the best, right? But how come we're not taking care of our own, right? Why aren't we taking care of our own?
And, you know, there's a corollary to that. As bad as we've allowed our cities to become through this whole idea of, you know, global trade will solve everything and we'll become a service provider and somebody else will be a manufacturer and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
You also have to look at what USAID or what foreign aid really does. And the poster child for that, is Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
Haiti is a country that we, so take the Clinton, at the Clintons, the, you know, all three of them.
Yeah.
They are supposed to have adopted Haiti. They were supposed to have, you know, that was the Clinton Foundation's poster child.
Yeah.
And yet, look what's happened to Haiti.
Yeah.
It has been, I mean, the country is, it's no longer a country. It's just pure chaos.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the law of the jungle. And, you know, the animals reign supreme.
Yeah.
And it's the, I mean, what's happened to Haiti is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And there is a situation where USAID or aid in general and interference by, in general, the attempt to, quote, help has been catastrophic. And hundreds of thousands of lives have been ruined.
Yeah.
Maybe millions. Who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, nobody knows what's going on. Nobody can tell you what's really happening in Haiti.
This was after, what was it, the earthquake or the hurricane that hit the region that sent it?
Well, they've had terrible natural disasters.
Yeah. Super unlucky.
But the real disaster is not the natural disasters. Other countries have had natural disasters and we've helped them survive. But so much help, so much support, so much money has been poured into it. And that money has stuck to a lot of fingers on its way there.
Yeah.
And so it became, anyway, let's get off that subject because all I'm trying to say is, yeah, I mean, it's unclear whether foreign aid is of any value at all.
Yeah.
And there are terrible things going on in the world, you know, terrible things going on in the world that, where we could help.
Yeah.
The question is, are we helping?
It feels extremely inefficient in the best case scenario.
Yes.
Right? In the best case scenario, it feels like and what's crazy too, these are taxpayer funded things that are happening, right? It's the United States, however small it might be, there's still money coming out of 50% of America or 40% of America, whatever you want to call it, 20% of America that's living paycheck to paycheck. They're living in derelict conditions. And then some of their tax dollars are going to help somebody, some other body outside of the United States. I'm not saying those people don't deserve help. What I'm saying is that's the reality. And I think that is such a difficult thing to defend when the country has been printing as much as it's been printing for the last 20 years and the debt it's where it's at. It's obvious that we haven't taken care of our own.
Yeah, we haven't.
At all. Yeah. And it's a Republican and Democrat issue. Like, this is not a Biden thing or a Trump thing. This is since Clinton did a surplus that one year, you know, and 9/11 happened, the financial crisis, all that stuff. But it's obvious that the underpinnings of our government are not, like, we don't have any discipline. We don't have any true leadership when it comes to fiscal responsibility, right? And I think this, for the first time that I've sort of studied, and I could be wrong in this, but it feels like we finally have some sort of fiscal responsibility that it's like, hey, we have to do the hard things. We have to do the stupid things sometimes. We have to make mistakes to get to where we need to go. But it's incredibly important that we get this debt under control and we get inflation under control and we get ourselves in a position where we actually have a positive future 20 years from now,
right,
versus having assured bankruptcy, essentially.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Well, the real question is how well this short-lived administration can actually achieve its goal and whether, you know, this disruptive way of governing will be positive or negative.
What does your gut tell you? Not your brain, your gut.
My gut. I'm not I'm not very hopeful. My gut tells me that there is such opposition, there's such strong opposition, there's such strident opposition that things could derail pretty quickly in terrible ways, you know, really nasty ways. I mean, just look at the demonstration going on this morning. I mean, every day there's another, you know, serious demonstration. So I'm not that hopeful. I mean, I'm amazed at Trump's brutal honesty, as well as his duplicity.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it's strange that
Schrodinger's Trump.
Schrodinger's Trump. Yeah. Brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah. And I'm, you know, I'm excited by what Elon is achieving, but very worried for Elon.
Yeah.
Very worried for all of his properties, all his assets, and very worried for the mission that they are achieving for the United States. On the other hand, I'm very hopeful, you know, that this reality of our debt is finally tackled, and it's being tackled in the right way. I mean, if you cut this bureaucracy overnight by 2/3, it would make an enormous impact.
Gigantic. Yeah.
And that's what they're trying to do. But it's very difficult because there are so many interests so well embedded.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Let me, when did you take a position in Tesla, Larry? When was your first time?
Wow. Well, I started very small, right?
Yeah.
Right after the IPO.
But you followed the FUD wars of 2015.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so let me ask you this.
Part of those.
So I was in the company from 17 to 21. So my perception of the FUD wars may be different because I was too damn busy to pay attention to what was going on, right? But I'm curious to get your take. If you think about, like, if we shift focus to Elon industry and look at Tesla sort of, and, you know, I know SpaceX had their Starship blew up in space or whatever, it was a test, but, you know, you can see how the media and the left want to paint it as a failure,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the Tesla one's very specific because you're having all these riots, you're having all these, you know, vandalism, which is absolutely inexcusable, that, like, nobody should do that whatsoever. And I'm a little bit upset by how little denouncing there is from one side of the political spectrum, but I put that aside. So how do you view the current climate as it pertains to Tesla from a perception standpoint versus what was happening in 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018?
This is the next level.
It feels like an order of magnitude worse.
This is the next level. Yeah. There is no comparison.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
And how much of it is legitimate?
Oh, none of it is legitimate. None of it's legitimate. I mean, it. You know, the value of Tesla is the Elon leadership. There's no doubt about it. I mean, his ability to go in and say, yeah, we got to cut by 10%. You know, the stocks, I go back to 2022, he cuts by 10%, or 2023, I forget which year. He cuts by 10%. The stocks way up, you know, business is fantastic.
Yeah.
And he just cuts. Everybody goes, what, you know? But he says, we're getting too fat. And I mean, that level of perception, that level of control of cost, that level of, you know, just getting down to the basics of business is extraordinary. You don't see it in American management. You don't see it in management anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
It's just extraordinary. He is, I think, the best cost control CEO on earth.
100%. I agree. Yeah.
And that's like the least of his skills.
Yeah.
You know, to have all those skills in one person is extraordinary. Now, on the other hand, we have to deal with the personality.
Yeah.
And his personality is he sees a problem, he understands a problem, and if it's important enough, he tackles it head on.
Regardless of what happens.
Regardless of what happens.
Yeah.
He is completely oblivious to the politics of it.
Yeah.
He doesn't care about it.
Yeah. And we've seen He'll stoke it.
Right. And so, you know, for us mere mortals, it's
uncomfortable.
I mean, I was looking for something a little bit, you know, a little bit higher than uncomfortable. Yeah. It's
amusing.
No, quite the opposite. It's horrifying.
Yeah.
You know, we can't get our heads around it because, you know, we've learned to be very polite to each other and to say nice things and say, on the other hand, you know, maybe that's not Elon's way.
Yeah.
He's a different person for sure.
Yeah, I think, I agree with you 1,000%. I think the thing that I've been very, that I'm trying to gauge is, regardless of how much noise and how much fear is happening right now, even if it's an order of magnitude more impactful, the reality is that if you think about Tesla's brand awareness and Elon's brand awareness in 2015 to 2020 and through today, his awareness is probably 10 times larger. If you just look at it from a pure sort of like how many people know who Elon Musk is, how many people know what Tesla is, right? So by default, the net number of people that will be voicing an opinion or paying attention to the story will automatically 10x, right? And if you're doing very controversial / chaotic things, by default, the amount of hate and love you're going to get is going to be also 10x, right? So you're getting a double, you're getting an 100x impact. There's more people going even crazier because of how chaotic and almost unpredictable Elon is in a certain ways, and how he manages his brand, which I would argue he doesn't manage his brand at all. And neither does Trump. They're just like, this is who I am, take it or leave it, which I think a lot of people respect. And I think that's why they have the support they have.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, Elon's philosophy is build a great product and people will come.
Yeah.
You know, and that has always been his philosophy. He doesn't believe in advertising. He doesn't believe in, you know, publicity and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But of course, he's achieved brand recognition out of all proportion. I mean, yesterday I walked into the airport got into the security line. The security guy says to me, sees my SpaceX t-shirt, said, "Do you work for Elon Musk?" I said, "No, I'm just wearing a shirt." "Oh, I want to work for Elon Musk."
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, it cuts both ways. But my gosh, it gets pretty nasty.
Yeah. And so like what I'm trying to drive with that is, okay, so we can be in our bubbles, we can be online, we can be tracking all this stuff, right? And it seems so chaotic. But when I drive down here to Capital Factory, I saw like 3 Cybertrucks, and half the cars on the road are either Model 3s or Model Ys.
Yeah.
And everybody's just living their life. Yeah. I'm like, okay, all right. So there is definitely, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, a negative hit that's being that Tesla's taking right now, for sure, in some areas more than others.
Yes.
I don't live in Europe, but I'm sure there's a lot of pissed off people at Elon,
yes,
especially around his comments with Ukraine,
yes,
and the stuff that went on in Germany. For sure, Tesla's going to take some sort of negative impact from let's say one side of the political spectrum,
right?
Whose values are aligned with the thing that Elon doesn't want to do, right? Okay. Or is very violently against, let's say. So for sure, that's the case. On the other hand, we have people that now, like that Trump tweet of like, "Hey, I'm gonna buy a Tesla tomorrow," and Sean Hannity buying a Model S. And I think the Fox and Friends guys were like, "Everybody should go out and buy a Tesla." Imagine this happening 12 months ago. It's so weird.
Right.
So weird that the pro-climate party is vandalizing electric vehicles and the pro-oil party is like, "Everybody go get a Tesla."
Right.
What happened?
It's extraordinary. It's truly extraordinary.
Like, what world are we living in right now? This is crazy.
It is crazy. Look, I mean, and the thing is, it's a complex world.
I think most people don't care. The point I'm trying to get at is like, I think a middle 60 does not care. They live their life with best bang for my buck, especially business owners, just give me the math. Does it work? Great. I'm going to get into that thing, right? And I think that's how most people operate. And so the point I'm trying to get to is like, okay, so is this attention really that bad for the brand, truly? Like, is the awareness that's being raised for Tesla, it's entered the mainstream in a way that it would have never entered if it was, let's say, the Biden or Kamala administration, right?
Well, you're looking at the glass half full.
I have to.
I can give you the glass half empty side of that conversation. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is, any brand manager will tell you what's happening to the brand is really bad.
Mm.
Because, you know, getting that level of brand recognition with brand hatred is not great.
Yeah.
Because you're functionally halving your TAM.
Well, there's, I mean, in the United States, 25%, 28% of the country is Democrat. So do you really think it's halving the TAM?
Well, I'm not sure those numbers.
You're hurting the brand regardless. Like, it's a stupid thing to do. Why
so
are
whether,
you
whether you're halving the brand or you're cutting the brand by 25%.
Why are you isolating potential customers?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but look, what, you know, we're doing this for the, I mean, we, Elon is doing this for the greater good. And frankly, if the brand were not harmed and the brand were doing great, but the country goes bankrupt.
Yeah.
The kind of, it's not good for the brand either.
100%. Yeah, yeah.
So it's really hard to, look, I'm not 100% aligned with Trump and I'm not 100% aligned with Elon.
Yeah.
For example, Ukraine. I'm a very strong supporter of Ukraine for historical reasons. You know, I'm a Jew out of those lands.
Yeah.
My family came from those lands. I have nothing but disdain for the Russian way of running countries. Mm-hmm. I have nothing disdain for the Russian government. And I don't agree one iota with this view by some in the MAGA movement that the Ukraine government is corrupt. David Sachs's view that Zelensky is corrupt and that it's corrupt. Yeah, Zelensky behaved extremely badly, stupidly, I would say, in the White House the other day. And it really cost him his entire, you know, future, or may have cost Ukraine its entire future. So stupidity was very high. But on the other hand, you know, I'm very strongly aligned with the Ukraine and wish that Trump would better recognize, and maybe he does, and maybe what he's doing is the right thing to solve this problem. And you know, I can't criticize Elon. He saved Ukraine. He personally, single-handedly saved Ukraine.
Starlink was a big deal.
I mean, nobody understands that. And the fact that people are criticizing, the fact that people on the Ukraine side are criticizing it hurts me very badly, because he's done an incredible thing, a miraculous thing for Ukraine with Starlink. And people criticize him, say, we're going to replace Starlink. There's nothing that can replace Starlink. And what he did out of his own pocket on day one from an instinctual, I mean, he should be given the Nobel Peace Prize for that.
Yeah.
He personally saved Ukraine.
Yeah.
And you can argue maybe he did or maybe he didn't, but the fact that what he did was so important, had such impact on Ukraine's ability to defend itself, you know, it needs to be written into the history books. It will be written into the history books. It'll be recognized as the single most important contribution to the defense of Ukraine.
Yeah.
And still today, the Ukraine depends entirely upon Starlink.
Yeah.
Now, Poland pays for, some percentage, I think 12 or 15%. They claim 50%, but it's probably closer to the 12 or 15% of the Starlink terminals. The U.S. government pays for some. But Elon is still paying out of his pocket for that, what he did.
Yeah.
And he's not recognized for it. He's disparaged for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, what do you think about the sort of argument that says, well, this is all his fault. Like, he should not have the rhetoric and he should not have the crudeness with which he communicates in public. Like this is, or just he's entirely wrong positions. Like this is his fault. Like, okay, so he helped Ukraine, but he's out there saying the really, let's say, harmful things to those people that feel like Ukraine's survival is existential and it's very, very important, right? Which a lot of people, you know, I think can very much make an argument for that case.
Well,
right?
I would make that argument. But on the other hand, and I'm really troubled by, you know, some of his rhetoric in this regard, because it sounds like he's parroting David Sacks. And, you know, I think David Sacks is wrong on this subject, although I have a lot of respect for David. A huge fan of his in other respects. Mm-hmm. But I disagree with him. And that's the thing that I don't understand in today's world. You can disagree with somebody, but still have very high regard for them and still be very friendly with
them. We've lost that.
And you know, I disagree with Elon in some of his perspectives. I'm not as bright as Elon, and I'm sure he's right and I'm wrong. But I still have, you know, the right to disagree
with him. I have a thesis about that.
Okay.
I think America for the last couple decades, like what is the goal of America? Like I think clear-headedness, if I think about it. Do you think that's been lost, though? Like, it's kind of blurry what America's supposed to be doing. Like, what's your purpose?
I simply go back to our founding documents. You know, we're not perfect.
Yeah.
But our founding documents are very, very close to perfect. I mean, they are extraordinary, and they've led to, you know, incredible success in our country. We're far from perfect. Every government we've ever had has had really serious trouble, serious problems, serious deficiencies. But if you compare us over the 300 years, 200 to 300 years, we've come out of it pretty well, given our founding documents, the intentions of our founders, and despite all that was wrong with us, how we've evolved. And I continue to find them very inspiring, and I think that's what we're about. So if you ask me what are we about, I think what our founding fathers said, and if you read the Federalist Papers, if you read the Constitution of the United States, and if you read the Declaration of Independence, I think it's very clear what we're about.
But I feel like in public discourse, it just feels like America has gotten so big and so powerful that the overarching reason why America is America is sort of lost in the zeitgeist. I don't get the sense. I think the lack of unity is due to, why we have so much divisiveness is because we are not on the same page as a country, period. Like I think there's no overarching thing that says, hey, this is why America is so awesome. We have one side of the political spectrum that is hell-bent on getting the country to be much more inward. Then we have the other side of the political spectrum that is all about empathy. And it's all about, listen, we have everything we have. There's so many people out there that are suffering, right? And the extremes executed in a very perverse manner. But that's like the overarching thesis. But I feel like the acceptance of like, hey, this is what actually makes America awesome. Like, it's okay to love America. It's okay to be very, very, even with all our flaws, it's okay for us to come together as a country. I just don't get that sense. I didn't get that sense from Clinton, Hillary. You know, this is my near sort of history based on what I follow. You know, half the country are deplorables, right? Then we have Trump's very divisive rhetoric. And then we have Biden, who didn't exist. Right. It was just whatever was behind him was running the show. And then
whoever owned the automatic signature machine.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And then with Trump, too, I personally feel like there is a little bit more towards like, hey, let's find some national identity. Let's find some more of that. Hey, this is what America's.
Well, awesome. His rhetoric doesn't help.
It's not helping the left come towards him, you know, and I don't know if. And the argument I hear is like, well, listen, the left are a bunch of psycho woke people. And I'm like, okay, maybe the extreme, but what about sort of the middle left that voted for Kamala? That's like, I'm going to vote for the Democrats because I don't think total victory for the right side of the political spectrum is a good thing for America. There needs to be a healthy, strong Democrat side. There needs to be a healthy, strong left-leaning, so that there's the actual competition of ideas to get us moving forward. And that's missing from this country. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. It's like, I feel like it's also disheveled.
It's very confusing. You know, if you go back to Goldwater versus Johnson, I heard the very same conversation in 1964.
Okay.
What's
Goldwater versus Johnson?
That was the election. Those were the the candidates. Lyndon Johnson versus Barry Goldwater. Those were the candidates.
Assassination.
Yeah, that was the first election after the assassination.
Yeah.
And you didn't even know that. But this Lyndon conversation.
Johnson, I'm like, who's? I thought it was like a lawsuit or something.
Yeah. But Goldwater versus Johnson, the very same rhetoric that you're talking about now, you know, different. And it's interesting because Johnson came from, you know, the extreme right and he journeyed to the extreme left.
Mm.
Goldwater was the Reagan of his time. In fact, Reagan was, you know, he was at Goldwater. He made the great speech, one of his greatest speeches, during the nomination of Goldwater at the convention. You should actually look up that speech.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you go back in history and you can see the rhetoric of both sides as extreme, if you know, every one of these presidential elections, the history of the United States is replete with extreme, you know, real anger and.
So this is nothing new, is what you're saying?
It's not new.
Yeah, it's not new.
It's been going on for years.
Yeah. And okay.
It's not all bad. It's, you know, out of this will emerge. I think the woke movement is on its way to its deathbed.
Yeah.
There'll always be extremes that will pursue it. I have a cousin who's part of the most extreme of that woke movement. I mean, he's a registered communist.
Nice.
I mean, I don't think we haven't spoken for 70 years.
Okay.
So it exists in families. It's going to exist in the country.
Yeah.
I don't think it's new.
Yeah.
It just seems each time we get to the crisis of the contest, it just seems like the worst time in the world. But, you know, there was a time when the Soviet Union was ascendant.
Yeah.
And the left, you know, saw it as a potential solution to human problems, even in this country. And at the height of the Cold War, they were supportive of it. And there was a lot of spies, just as there right now, a lot of spies for China active in our country. There were a lot of spies active in our country who were not necessarily appointed as spies, but who were very sympathetic to the communist movement, as there are many communists now in the country who believe in that.
Yeah. So what's funny is that the takeaway from my conversation is that there is some hope. It feels more hopeful than not, you know? It's so that time, history repeats itself. It doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, right? That's one takeaway there. And it seems like having this kind of discourse and all the sort of varying opinions and with the intensity that we hear it, that could mean that, hey, we are, after all, in a democracy and it's supposed to feel uncomfortable.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, all the above.
So this is great.
It all depends on which side of the bed you get out
right,
in the morning.
Course, of
yeah,
course.
Yeah. Okay. Sanders, this is a very easy discourse because we find ourselves in a very similar political position. So it's very easy to have this discourse.
Yeah.
Would this discourse have as simple a resolution if we were from opposite sides?
Probably not.
Probably not.
I think the other person would feel like the current time is an existential crisis because we're falling into a dictatorship.
Yeah, and that would have been flipped just a year ago.
Yeah, because the same exact rhetoric was towards the Kamala and Biden administration with their crackdown of speech.
I mean, I'm still sitting here today wondering how somebody could have voted for Kamala.
I agree with you.
Well, you see,
it's never Trump. Never Trump.
Never Trump.
Never Trump is a powerful
thing. I understand the never Trump. Yeah. I was right there, so I do understand it. Yeah, the man, complicated. It's complicated.
It's very complicated, yeah. Okay, this was fun.
That was fun.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.